Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. This week, Governor Matt Mead signed the Indian Education for All Act into law. The Wyoming Humanities Council plans to get that education into schools and libraries right away.
We're really proud to be part of at least opening up a new way to look at this history.
We will have a special report on migrant education. And the Colorado Sun is a newspaper that cropped up after a number of journalists left the Denver Post.
We were under attack by our own owners.
We will also revisit our story on a new tourism degree at the University of Wyoming.
That it really was about the business of the tourism economy and what the vision could be. And so we got very excited about it.
And a special interview with musician Herb Albert. Join us for Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. For years, Wind River Reservation tribal advocates have suggested that Wyoming students lack access to authentic education about the state's Native American heritage. Some said that has led to insensitive or even racist encounters when tribal sports teams travel to other school districts. But last year, lawmakers passed a bill called Indian Education for All that will require schools to teach the history and culture of the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone as part of the social studies curriculum statewide. To help do that, the Wyoming Humanities Council has now developed exhibits to be placed in all Wyoming school districts and library systems. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with Humanities Council Director Shannon Smith to learn more.
We're really excited. We've completed, this has been a year and a half of kind of crowdsourced development using experts from both tribes on the reservation as well as ethnohistorians and scholars from around the region. And we're super excited at this point because the prototype has been out. We've shown it at the Wyoming Native American Education Conference and got some great feedback there. So we anticipate they'll be printed in this coming month and distributed to every school district, every library system, and quite a few school districts have asked for multiple copies. And each copy we've figured is worth about $1,500. And we're able to give this free of charge because we were able to raise funds from lots of organizations and from the state and from our NEH funding in order to make this happen.
So can you kind of describe what these kiosks will look like?
They're gorgeous, for one thing. They really have some beautiful imagery. We've got a lot of photographs that came from the American Heritage Center, and we also have some great landscapes. And so when the person who opens it up, let's say it's a middle school teacher, opens this box up, it'll be a long, flat box, but it will assemble to about 4 foot by 4 foot by 5 foot high. And it's on all sides, and it has little slots on the side that contain a kid's guide and an adult's guide. So we really have the same content, but it can be consumed by a great variety of ages.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And so, what has been the Wyoming Humanities Council's role kind of in the process of putting together the idea of Indian Education for All that was passed as legislation last year?
Yeah, this was, we've just felt it was a very important step for Wyoming to take, given our population. And we were really shocked and pleased that our legislature moved so quickly and so positively to pass this law. But it was very clear that there wasn't enough content out there yet. Wyoming Public Television has some great modules, video modules of interviews, and there were a few places that had a bit of content, but we heard that just right away teachers were going to be looking for material to use. And it was so rewarding to see how many organizations in this state jumped into this space. And we were able to host an event just this February that featured, 10 organizations that had either books or online websites or curricular materials or games that people could play to learn about American Indian history, and in particular to learn about the Wind River Reservation and its history.
And yeah, can you talk a little bit more about why that's so important, and you know, maybe what has been some of the information that our students around the state haven't known about Wind River Reservation?
Well, this was a really challenging project because there's a lot of context and nuance, and there's disagreements, and that's what history is all about. And I can't say, or any of my organization can't say, that we got it 100% right, but our heart was in the right place as we gathered the materials to assemble. What you're talking about here are two tribes that have unique cultural identities and unique histories, and ended up in the Wind River region and on this reservation in two completely different series of legal and historical circumstances. That was really part of the work, was we don't see that very often. There's great historical documentation about the Eastern Shoshone, and there's great historical documentation about the Northern Arapaho, but less that focuses on that intersection and what brought both tribes to that region. And we're really proud to be part of at least opening up a new way to look at this history.
So what was your process of putting together these exhibits? How did you, draw in from both tribes and make sure that you were as accurate as possible?
Yeah, and that's where I like to say it was crowdsourced. One of the things that our program officer, who did an amazing job on this work, and you can imagine the coordination of reaching out to, you know, three dozen of both tribe members, as well as many scholars as she could find, and then try to get responses back by a certain date. And these people were asked to read an extensively long and detailed research document.
And I wonder if part of that kind of crowdsourcing, you know, really fulfills the mission of Wyoming Humanities Council.
Well, we heard from several friends and associates from the reservation that they felt this was going to be as beneficial to them to use to teach on the reservation as it is for what our original intent was, which is to teach all Wyomingites, especially those that don't know much or anything at all about our reservation that's right in the heart of our state. And so it really became kind of an honor that we're able to present this content to help the teachers on the reservation teach their students there. So it really was a powerful thing that we learned after we got going.
Yeah. All right. Well, I look forward to seeing them for sure.
Yeah, it's exciting. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Shannon.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll have an interview with musician Herb Alpert, who is in Wyoming this weekend. This is Open Spaces. You are listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. If you know this, then you know Herb Alpert. 50-some-odd years later, the jazz musician is still going strong with new albums and a tour. And his art is not confined to just music. Alpert is a visual artist, creating sculptures and abstract expressionist paintings that have shown in museums all around the world. Over the next couple of months, both his music and his art will come to Wyoming with an exhibition and a gallery in Jackson and performances in Jackson and Sheridan. He joined Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard to talk about how he started creating visual art in the first place.
We were traveling around the world with the Tijuana Brass in the 60s, and I used to go to museums and kind of gravitate towards the modern art section, and I just got excited about seeing the works of, artists that are just expressing themselves in a creative way. And I guess, the one that really touched me was the painting, like a black painting with a purple dot, and then a green painting with a white dot, and wondering why that was hanging on the wall. So I just bought some canvas and paints and got back home and started moving paint around like a monkey, just trying to have a little fun on canvas. And then I found I was having a pretty good time, and I kept it up. And little by little, it started evolving into something that really made me feel great. that experience that I think all kids should have at an early age, you know, that feeling of just creating. I think all kids are creative. We kind of beat the creativity out of them. I think the public schools and the private schools ought to have that as a core subject for all kids.
Is this the passion that drives your philanthropic work, funding some of these art and music initiatives for children?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I had this unusual opportunity when I was 8 years old, and I need to pass that one on because at my school, the elementary school, there was a music class, and there was a table filled with instruments, and I happened to pick up the trumpet, and the trumpet was talking for me because I was very shy. I was an introvert. I am an introvert, but when I was a child, I was even more mute. So that instrument was saying things I couldn't get out of my mouth, and obviously it changed my life. And I think that experience was a pivotal experience for me.
Between your music and your visual art, is there a common thread that sort of weaves between the two?
Well, I think all artists have to be authentic. You have to just respond to your own instincts. You can't pit yourself against, if I'm painting or sculpting and I think, oh, am I as good as Michelangelo? And, well, I don't think so, So I think you just have to be your own judge. I think part of the reason is a lot of people get sidetracked with trying to create is they judge too hard. They do their work and wonder if it's good or bad, and then they end up with it, I think it's not so good, and that's stops them. But I think to really be a good artist, you have to just appreciate what you can do and let it be at that level.
If you had a free afternoon, would you rather paint, sculpt, or play music?
Well, I do all three. I wake up early in the morning and I usually sculpt a bit in the kitchen. I have a little setup in our kitchen that my wife's not crazy about, but I sculpt with wax. And then I go in the studio and I blow the horn for a little while. I do some exercises that I like. I'm kind of conditioned to do that. I miss it when I don't. And then I'll go into the art studio and look at a canvas and see if I feel something for what I had started. And that's it. I don't force it. I don't think you can force art. You can't try to make something that's worth anyone else looking at. I don't even think of it that way. I feel like if it touches me, it might touch somebody else. And I feel that same way about music. I make music that I feel if it's fun for me to play, it's going to be fun for a certain amount of people to listen to.
One thing I know some artists struggle with is, keeping something fresh. And if something's fun for you to play, I'm just thinking, songs like A Taste of Honey or The Lonely Bull. You've been playing these songs for decades. How do you not get sick of them?
They're good songs. A good song is a good song. Even when I recorded them, I didn't look at the music and record them, note for note. I just kind of play. Each time I play that song or those songs, I try to bring a little freshness to it. But that's only part of the show. We do a Tijuana Brass medley, but surrounding the medley that we play, there's a lot of spontaneity and a lot of songs that are just really fun and innovative. So that's what keeps me going all every time we play. We're playing about 50 concerts this year, and I look forward to it because I get to express myself. I'm not quite sure exactly how I'm going to play that particular day or night. There's a lot of improvisation, so it's a nice challenge.
And you mentioned earlier that you're an introvert. Is it hard to be a sort of a public person with that introvert quality? How have you balanced that?
Yeah, it's strange because, in the middle of a party with lots of people or more than one person or two, yeah, I get a little uptight, but it's amazing. I can play on stage for 10,000, 20,000 people, and that's never been a problem. So when I'm removed, I'm fine. But right in the middle of all the action is not something I like to do.
I'm speaking with jazz musician and artist Herb Alpert. Herb, can you tell me a little bit about your collaboration and relationship with Sam Cooke?
Oh, Sam Cooke taught me a lot. Sam, I was partners with Lou Adler at the time, and we wrote some songs for Sam, and then the three of us wrote Wonderful World. Don't know much about history.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
And Sam was a very unusual artist. He came out of the gospel field. He was the lead singer with the group called the Soul Stirrers. And he was always saying, Herb, you know, the people are just listening to a cold piece of wax, brother. He says, either it makes it or it don't. You know, that sounded like, you know, simple advice, but that's exactly what was happening. He was very, very creative, and he was teaching, but he didn't know he was. You know, he used to carry around a notebook filled with lyrics, and one day he came up to me and says, Herbie, what do you think of this lyric? And I looked at it, and it was like the corniest lyric I had ever seen. You know, but I didn't say that to him. I was just looking at this lyric, looking at him, thinking, I wonder what he had in mind when he wrote this. I said, what does the song sound like? He picked up his guitar and turned that lyric into magic. It, all of a sudden, that lyric made sense. It just had a life of its own. And I was thinking, after that experience, I think, man, it ain't what you do. It's the way how you do it.
Yeah. How have you kept that going and kept that alive for yourself all these years later?
You know, like when I'm recording and I'm producing a record and I'm playing trumpet on that record and I'm listening to the playback, I'm not listening to myself. I'm listening. I'm an audience. And that's what I've learned to do. I become an audience to what I do, even with the painting and the sculpting and the music. I look at it from another angle. So when I'm recording and I listen to a playback of the music, and I'm not listening to the trumpet player, I'm listening to the overall feeling. Because I think when it comes down to it, all the arts, acting, poetry, music, whatever it happens to be, sculpting, it's all about feel. That's all the people respond to. That's all I respond to. That's the thing. I don't think you can identify art. It's that thing, it's that magic thing that happens. It's that thing that happens when you don't know it's happening. It gets you. It gets your body. I don't think people listen with their ears. They listen with their soul. And if something touches them, they get goosebumps.
An opening reception for the show Herb Alpert of Visual Melody will take place at Heather James Fine Art Tuesday, August 21st. Herb Alpert and his wife, Lonnie Hall, will be live in concert Wednesday the 22nd at the Center for the Arts in Jackson, and he will be playing a show in Sheridan, Wyoming at the Wyoming Theater September 22nd. Herb Alpert, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
I'm looking forward to all those events, and Carol, so nice talking to you too.
When we come back, Tennessee Watson has a special report on migrant education. Stay with us on Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Last year, education reporter Tennessee Watson discovered that Wyoming would no longer run the federally funded Migrant Education Program, which provides academic support to children who move from school to school because their parents do seasonal farm and fisheries work. That got Tennessee wondering, what's school like for migrant students in other states? With support from the Solutions Journalism Network, Tennessee has been working on a project called School on the Move. That reporting is the focus of the following episode of the Educate podcast from APM Reports.
They travel in buses. They ride trucks. They follow the sun.
That is legendary CBS News correspondent Edward R. Murrow.
They are the migrants, workers in the sweatshops of the soil.
His documentary was called Harvest of Shame. CBS aired it the day after Thanksgiving.
Harvest of Shame came out in 1960.
And this is Tennessee Watson. She's an education reporter at Wyoming Public Radio. We're going to talk with her on this episode of the podcast about the education that children of migrant workers got in the past and what's available to them today.
And, you know, the big takeaway from this film, which aired across the country, was that while you're enjoying your Thanksgiving feast, the food that's on your table is harvested by people who can't even afford to buy that.
We should like you to meet some of your fellow citizens who harvest the food for the best fed nation on earth.
So he keeps trying to make this point that this level of poverty and exploitation is something that's happening right here in the United States.
How old were you when you first started working in the fields?
8.
You've been working 21 years in the fields?
That's right.
Aileen, do you ever think you'll be able to get out of this kind of work?
No, sir.
You know, Murrow also spends a lot of time in the Harvest of Shame talking to parents about the lives of their children.
6 decades after Harvest of Shame, Tennessee Watson set out to see what school is like for today's children of migrant workers. She found that those workers are still among the lowest paid people in the country. They still do really dangerous work, but their kids have a much better shot at not being migrant workers when they grow up. That's because of education. The migrant families that Edward R. Murrow talked with had little hope of getting an education. Today, many more migrant kids are going to school and even to college. From APM Reports, this is Educate, a podcast in collaboration with the Hechinger Report. I'm Stephen Smith. The Migrant Education Program gives local school districts federal money to keep migrant kids in school even as their families move around. The program's been going for 50 years, and it works, even though most people don't know about it. Tennessee Watson says migrant education got a boost because of the Great Society programs in the 1960s.
We have the opportunity to move not only toward the rich society and the powerful society, but upward to the Great Society.
President Lyndon Johnson, you know, had the Great Society program, and the idea, to sort of paraphrase Johnson, was that no child would go unfed and that no youngster would go unschooled, and really had this vision of citizens having the means to lead full, meaningful lives.
The Great Society rests on abundance and liberty for all. It demands an end to poverty and racial injustice, to which we're totally committed in our time.
And so a part of that was declaring war on poverty and racial injustice. And one of the pathways to overcoming poverty and racial injustice was this focus on education.
So we must give every child a place to sit and a teacher to learn from. Poverty must not be a bar to learning, and learning must offer an escape from poverty.
And so as a part of that effort, the Great Society and the War on Poverty, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965 was passed. And a part of that was Title I, which was federal dollars specifically to support low-income students. You know, one of the most famous parts of Title I, I think that a lot of people across the United States know, is the free and reduced lunch program. So to make sure that low-income kids have access to food. And despite the attention that the Harvest of Shame had given to the plight of migrant students, migrant education wasn't included in the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. And it's interesting because in Harvest of Shame, Murrow makes this point where he says, you know, the federal government spends more money on migrant birds than they do on migrant kids.
The federal government spends $6.5 million annually protecting migratory wildlife. This year, Congress failed to appropriate $3.5 million to educate migratory children.
He tells us that there's only 6 states that even have programs for migrant kids.
Approximately 1 out of every 500 children whose parents are still migrant laborers finishes grade school. Approximately 1 out of every 5,000 ever finishes high school. And there is no case upon the record of the child of a migrant laborer ever receiving a college diploma.
So he makes a pretty compelling case for the need for more support and services for migrant students. And there was a congressman from Michigan named William Ford who sort of caught that gap. And he was from a state where there were a lot of migrant farm workers. And he was able to write legislation and get it passed that added migrant students to Title I in 1966.
This was the Migrant Education Program, is that right?
Yep.
Well, who qualified as a migrant student?
So it's any child between the ages of 3 through 21, so up until they're 22, that doesn't have a high school diploma and whose parents have moved to do seasonal, agricultural, or fisheries work. And students, say you're 16 and you're already moving on your own, but you don't have a high school diploma, then those students who are moving themselves for work are also eligible for support. And over time, it's come to include other kinds of migratory seasonal workers. So it includes folks who work in the timber industry, the fishing industry. It also extends to processing. So if you're not out harvesting cherries, but you're in the freezer packing them, then your kids would qualify. If you're not out fishing, but you're working in a canning facility, then your kids would also qualify.
How does it work? Who is actually making contact with migrant students?
Well, it can happen a number of different ways. So, you know, one line of connection is a kid moves to a new school and folks that work in that school are hip to the fact that there's a migrant education program. So for every new student that walks through the door, they would screen them and say, hey, in the last 36 months, have your parents done agricultural work or moved to get a job in agricultural work? So you can screen students as they come into school. Another possibility is there are recruiters that work for migrant education programs in different states who will know that farm workers are arriving at camps and go out and interact with parents and interact with children and get them signed up that way. And there's also this acknowledgement of the fact that kids aren't always going to come to school. And so there's this outreach effort in a lot of states to go out and recruit them. And that's become increasingly important with that demographic that I talked about, this, you know, the 16 or 17-year-old who still doesn't have a high school diploma but is moving for work potentially on their own. You know, that person's not going to show up at the door of the local high school, but a recruiter might be able to go out, find out how old folks are, ask them what their education history is, and then help get them hooked up with a GED program.
You also went to Maine to talk with a woman named Juana Vasquez, who works with kids that migrate with the blueberry harvest and the fishing season there. Can you tell us a bit about what her work is like?
Juana Vasquez is from a migrant farm worker family herself. She came to Maine in fourth grade, and that was the first time in her memory that she stopped moving.
We started up in Florida and did oranges, and then every year we will move to Michigan and do crops over there. We would do strawberries, tomatoes, green peppers. We would wait up until apples and finish apple season, and then we would go back to Florida. And then one year, one of my father's friends came up to Maine, and they were starting a sea cucumber factory here in Millbridge. And he went back down and told my father, oh, you should come. There's a lot of work over here. That's how we started. That's how we got here, was for the sea cucumber factory. And then the sea cucumber factory would close, and my father would work in the blueberry fields after that.
So she does the coordination of the migrant education program in this one part of Down East Maine, which has a lot of different things going on. There's lobster processing. There's a big blueberry harvest that brings in thousands of workers. They make wreaths there. And it's, you know, there's enough work, but it doesn't fill an entire year. So there are workers that are coming and going from that area. And it's really her job to, you know, manage the cases of these students and help to ease those transitions.
So it's almost 7 o'clock at night, and we're heading towards Harrington with a new family that just moved 3 days ago. And we just enrolled her today in school. So she would be starting school tomorrow morning at 7:30. And we're gonna be dropping off some school supplies to get her ready for school tomorrow.
I went with her to visit a student the night before she was gonna start school in Maine for the first time. And instead of just showing up at school the next morning and passing off some supplies to her there, she went out of her way on a cold, frosty Maine evening to go and meet Yoelis and her mom, Jennifer, just to kind of, you know, ease her worries and talk her through what it's going to be like at that first day, and to make sure that she had paper and pencils and that she knew where the bathroom was in the school, all these little details just to kind of like ease that transition for her. And I think that's because Juana remembers what it was like to show up at a new school.
She's going to be going to school tomorrow. She needs to have that confidence that she's ready to be in school, that support, that somebody is helping her, that she's not alone. So just to...
Well, she also is being really creative in how she's using migrant education funds. So she's taking kids on field trips to colleges, making sure that migrant students know they can go to college. She's doing career development, introducing them to professionals so that they, you know, can meet somebody who's doing something besides farm work. And then there's also a tutoring program. And then this more traditional sort of case management where she's looking at their grades and just kind of checking in with them about how they're doing. And then the other thing that she does is she is really this interface between workers and schools. And she's able to say to a school, hey, a ton of lobster just came in. Everybody's working 14-hour shifts. And there's parent-teacher conferences scheduled this week. There's no way that these parents who are processing lobster are going to be able to make those meetings. Can we come up with times that work with them?
Now, you're based in Wyoming. How did you become first interested in this subject, the state of migrant education?
Well, I became interested because I was reviewing my state's ESSA plan and just looking at, oh, what's going to change with Every Student Succeeds Act? And I noticed that Wyoming said that they were no longer going to take the federal funds for the migrant education program. And I checked around and people said, you know, there have been less and less migrant farm workers, fewer and fewer migrant farm workers coming to Wyoming because of changes in technology. So they use the Roundup Ready beet, and the beet harvest was the main thing that drew workers to the state. Using the Roundup Ready beet requires a lot less weeding and tilling. So, you know, with the introduction of that new beet, fewer and fewer people came, and there was a decline in the number of migrant students. So the last count that they had was about 108 students, and they decided to phase out their program. And I looked at that and I was like, like there have been changes in agriculture across the country that have decreased the need for farm workers. And I was just curious, like, is this a thing that's happening in other states?
And is it?
No, it does not seem to be happening in other states. I got support from the Solutions Journalism Network to kind of go out and poke around. And I wanted to go to other small states with a decline and say, like, are you still into this? Is this still helpful? Is it still worth your time? And, you know, North Dakota has seen a decline and they seem fully invested in it. It draws back families year after year to come back and work. It brings in resources for their school. It pays teachers to work during the summer, and it hires bus drivers, and they, you know, can buy materials to support migrant students that then stay in that school and benefit students that are there year round. And then I went to Maine, and they're still fully invested and doing a lot of creative things. They're leveraging that funding to really encourage students to go to college. So it's kind of this next level, like, let's not just get you a high school diploma, but let's, you know, get you interested in a career and in college. And when I asked other state directors, you know, if there'd been a conversation about ending programs, really didn't hear that from any other states.
How many kids are making use of this program now?
Well, according to the Department of Education, it's about 300,000 that are enrolled right now. And, you know, there's definitely a range. You've got states that are much bigger, like California and Texas, that are dealing with thousands and thousands and thousands of students, close to 90,000 in California, for example. And then you have states that are serving much smaller populations like North Dakota or Maine, New Hampshire, Nevada, and that's just hundreds of students.
You went to North Dakota and you met a student there named Angel. Tell us about him.
Well, Angel is 14. He's going to turn 15 this fall. He loves basketball. He loves school.
What I got taught to do was you write it together, so you do
he
one.
He really is proud of the fact that fraction. He's smart and that he likes to learn.
Line one,
and he is four, the kid of a family six, that's many generations five, of farm workers. His own parents grew up working in the fields alongside their parents. Neither of them graduated from high school. His mom made it to sixth grade.
You know, and she explained to me that my grandfather, he just put my mom and my aunts and my uncles, like they would go work on fields and he didn't give them the option to go to school. And she said that she really wishes that she had the opportunities because, you know, she feels bad for me that we have to like go back and forth and stuff. So that really makes me feel lucky that I have like the chance to like educate myself.
But Angel is roaring to go to college. He's, you know, entering ninth grade this fall, and he's totally convinced that he's going to go to college, and it's something that he really wants to do. He has an older brother who also grew up migrating between Texas and North Dakota who made it into college. So, you know, he sees that as a possibility, and he's going for it. But, you know, he still, despite the fact that he gets support from the Migrant Education Program, faces some barriers to really being able to access school and all that comes along with it. He wants to do extracurricular activities like math and history competitions, and he wants to play on the basketball team. And because he moves back and forth and doesn't start and end school in the same place, he's excluded from a lot of that extra stuff.
I told my mom, like, Mom, like, I don't want to leave too early where I don't make the basketball team here, or leave too late to where I don't make it over there and I'm going to like get stuck and I'm not going to be able to play at all. But like, you know, it's, you know, whatever, you know, God does things for a reason. So if it does happen, but I hope it really does, because I really want to play basketball really, really badly.
The U.S. Department of Labor reports that at least 50% of the farm worker population in this country is made up of undocumented immigrants. Is it hard for kids of undocumented farm workers to get into this migrant education program? Does it put them at them or their families at risk of being reported, given the current political climate?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to it. I can tell you that there were states that I contacted that were hesitant to talk to me, because they, you know, they know that there definitely is a portion of students that they're serving that are likely to be undocumented, just, you know, given that number you said about the percentage of farm workers that are undocumented. And so, you know, they were like, ooh, there's a lot of talk about migrant kids at the border, and we really don't want these things to be conflated. We'd rather just kind of fly under the radar and not have people know about the good work we're doing because we don't want to flag ourselves. So I did hear that on the part of educators, this desire to sort of be protective and not let a ton of people know about this program. And it serves, you know, not just farm workers and definitely not just Latinos. In Maine, there are white families that are served by this program, as well as Native American families. And that's, you know, true in other states as well. So when I ask educators if they feel like there's a hesitance or that folks are nervous about enrolling their kids in this program, the answer that I heard was no. But, you know, who knows? And what it looks like this year could be different from next year.
Edward R. Murrow's landmark documentary, as you've said, Harvest of Shame, came out in 1960, I believe, right?
Yeah.
How have things changed for the kids of migrant farm workers since then?
Well, I think one thing that I can see in the lives of Angel and Juana Vasquez, you know, Angel's in North Dakota, Juana is working for a migrant education program in Maine. They're growing up in an environment where they see farm workers breaking that cycle of poverty. So what Murrow described was, you know, there was no migrant student on record that had gone to college. And now Angel has grown up knowing a lot of farm worker kids that have gone on to college, including his own brother. And, you know, Juana is working for the migrant education program, and she's in school herself working on her teaching degree. And she's taking migrant students to visit schools, and she's helping to facilitate that process of them getting into college. So that is a huge shift. But there are things about their lives that are not actually that different from what's described in Harvest of Shame. They are still some of the lowest annual earners in the country. They do some of the most dangerous work because of their contact with heavy machinery and toxic chemicals that are involved with pesticides and fertilizers. So, you know, that's all still happening in the mix. But I think that there definitely is a different precedent set and a lot more hope for the students of farm workers that they can break that cycle of poverty and move on to another kind of work. I talked to Tom Ferry, who's a farmer in Manville, North Dakota, and also a former school board member.
I mean, that's kind of an interesting place for, like, an employer to be in, where you're hoping that the next generation doesn't do this.
Well, I guess we all have to adapt. That's just the way it is. Yeah, they're looking for something better, like everybody is, you know?
Tennessee Watson, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for this episode. Did you know about the Migrant Education Program? Does the Harvest of Shame still seem as relevant today as it was nearly 60 years ago? Tell us what you think. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Educate Podcast, or you can send us a note to contact@apmreports.org. Alex Baumhart and Chris Julin produced the podcast. Emily Hanford is our senior correspondent. This episode was mixed by Corey Schreppel. We partner with the Hechinger Report, a nonprofit independent news organization focused on inequality and innovation in education. Support for APM Reports comes from Lumina Foundation and the Spencer Foundation. I'm Stephen Smith. Thanks for listening. This is APM.
Check out more of Tennessee's reporting on migrant students. Go to schoolonthemovestories.org. Coming up, we'll wrap up the program. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. A news organization is about to launch in our region called the Colorado Sun. It's one of 14 publications that are part of an international experiment in reinventing journalism. As Ray Ellen Bichelle reports, the birth of the Sun starts with tribulations of a century-old newspaper.
The Denver Post wasn't dying, says Larry Rickman. It was being murdered.
We were under attack by our own owners.
Rickman was an editor at the newspaper. He says it all began when the hedge fund Alden Global Capital bought the Post. First, there were some layoffs, then more, then a third of the newsroom was cut. Then, he says something even more ominous happened. Censorship of stories about the whole ordeal.
And to me, that was the final straw.
But around the same time, a new media company called Civil reached out to Rickman with an offer.
We said that we want to give you a new home.
That's Matt Coolidge. He's a co-founder of the group, which aims to create a new place for journalism to live that doesn't involve billionaire publishers and hedge funds.
What we are ultimately trying to do is connect buyers and sellers. In this case, buyers just so happen to be those who want to read and support journalism, and sellers are journalists.
Coolidge and his colleagues had been watching as local publications across the country got sliced up after their owners decided they weren't profitable enough.
The San Antonio Express, the Miami Herald, the Kansas City Star, the San Jose Mercury News, the Oregonian. I could go on for another probably half hour on this. The common thread there is that none of these once venerated newsrooms are in control of their own destiny.
Civil wants to change that. More on that later. But first, over at the Denver Post, Rickman was intrigued. He says it sounded like it would give them a fighting chance.
And a fighting chance is more than we had working for a hedge fund.
With initial funding from Civil, Rickman and nine other staffers started a new publication, the Colorado Sun. They're now back in downtown Denver, within eyeshot of their old building, and they're gearing up to launch in September.
It's like we can just rock it.
Did you have a chance to look at the photos?
They're one of 14 newsrooms working with Civil across the U.S. and Asia, and that means learning about a new type of cryptocurrency.
I know, I think Dana and I are going to buy a few. Are you going to buy some?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yep, you heard right. Cryptocurrency. And this is where the whole Civil thing starts to get really complicated. It all hinges on something called Civil tokens.
What Civil is trying to do at its core is build a platform economy.
People will buy Civil tokens using real money for, at most, 94 cents each. They can then use those tokens to vote for newsrooms on the platform that they think are doing a good job. Alternatively, they can also vote what they consider bad newsrooms off the island. Coolidge says Civil has essentially made vetting good journalism into a game.
It could be called Spot the Unethical Newsroom and Keep It Off of This Platform.
But he stresses it won't be mob rule. Token holders can't just vote against newsrooms because they don't fit their point of view.
We have created a rule set for this economic game, and this is a document called the Civil Constitution.
That constitution says there is an objective truth. Journalists on the platform cannot knowingly produce misinformation. Token holders who support these rules by challenging an unethical newsroom can get rewarded in cryptocurrency. How exactly might this save local newsrooms? Shan Wang is a staff writer with the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard. She says that part is still pretty murky. After all, this whole new ecosystem for journalism doesn't exist yet. The Civil tokens, the core of the system, will go up for sale September 18.
I would never, ever believe that any one business model or any one technology or any ecosystem will be the one thing that, you know, saves journalism.
But she says it's an interesting experiment.
Yes.
And she says, who knows? A few years ago, people were just as befuddled about the internet and how it could change journalism. Maybe Civil will be the same. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
The University of Wyoming will be launching an outdoor recreation and tourism management degree this fall. It's been a three-year effort, but those in the industry have wanted the degree for almost 20 years. But everyone is happy now. Tourism and recreation is the second leading industry in the state. So it was crazy to many that the state's only four-year university wasn't interested in helping the industry develop young people who could potentially work the wide range of jobs the state has to offer. Then one day, Indy Burke, who at the time was the dean of the Hobbs School of Environment and Natural Resources, reached out to the director of the Wyoming Office of Tourism, Diane Schober.
And it was the first time ever that I had heard someone at the University of Wyoming talk about a tourism degree that was more than a natural resource conservation type of management degree, that it really was about the business of the tourism economy and what the vision could be. And so we got very excited about it.
Schober shared the information with those in the tourism field, and they were off and running.
The industry has weighed in all along the way, from early research to interviews to know we think this needs to be shaped a little bit differently here. And the university has been really responsive to that in working through the academic side and the input from the industry.
Schober notes there are jobs in the hospitality industry, at ski areas, museums, and state parks, and that's just to name a few. The Hobbs School's Doug Wachup did early legwork and held focus groups with business leaders. He was pleasantly surprised at the list of skills they asked for.
Communication skills, critical thinking skills, teamwork skills, ability to work in digital environments, things like that. They listed those out first, and then they began to talk about things, well, I need a marketing person, or I need someone with accounting skills, or I need guides, you know, those sorts of things.
The other thing the advisory group pushed for was developing people with entrepreneurial skills.
Folks that would actually begin to develop or build existing businesses, start new businesses, things like that.
Dan McCoy is in charge of the degree program. He says it'll be diverse and utilize a variety of programs across campus that involve such things as science, business, and the humanities, to name a few.
And the skills that we want that students to have coming from this degree is the ability to kind of adapt and change career paths and trajectories throughout their careers.
The degree will have four focus areas that will include business and hospitality management, outdoor recreation and leadership, as well as two more.
Cultural and international tourism, which is working with international visitors in a Western context, and then recreation resource management, a little bit more geared towards the ski area operations, guest ranches, dude ranches.
There is going to be a lot of classroom work, but Doug Wachob adds that hands-on is very important. Students will be encouraged to get internships, and a stronger real-world experience will also be part of the curriculum.
But we also designed a professional semester, which is a very focused, concentrated time in their senior year in which they'll actually be working in and around industry, around capstone projects and some other things like that.
Rick Howe of the Jackson Hole Chamber of Commerce says a degree program should develop high-quality employees who are ready to deal with the many challenges of a guest service industry.
Whether it's dealing with how staff interacts with people, whether you're dealing with conflict resolution, I mean, education is so key because what you're typically learning is the best ways to handle something.
Alex Klein is the vice president and general manager of the Grand Teton Lodge Company. He says the degree is very important, and he likes the mix of the curriculum, especially in an era where all businesses are becoming more complex. Klein also hopes this will keep Wyoming students at home and no longer lose them to other degree programs in other states.
You know, we are the second largest industry in Wyoming, and I think we want to be able to educate the future leaders of this industry right here in the state of Wyoming and not send them out of state to other colleges and universities, and I think have a question as to whether or not they're going to come back.
Cheyenne Little America General Manager Tony O'Brien agrees. He says it's sometimes difficult to hire people who know and love Wyoming. He thinks the UW program will take the industry to another level.
Not having a degree in tourism is, it hurts us. We're trying to grab people from other colleges that are close by, and you know, maybe they know or don't know about Wyoming, but I think it'll be really important to find quality long-term management employees that can hopefully last a long time.
Program coordinator Dan McCoy says there's a lot of student interest in the program, and not only from Wyoming, but from throughout the nation. The program will begin offering classes in the fall. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. We'll be back with you again next week. And don't forget to join us Tuesday night for live election coverage starting at 9 in the evening. We'll also have a complete wrap-up of election results Wednesday morning on Morning Edition. If you'd like to listen to interviews with the gubernatorial candidates, you can find them on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.